la 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 la.
Everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy, Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. And trust me, today I had to go get the purple shirt because I have a Fortis family member, and not only Fortis family, but the footballing fraternity family from way back when, a young man that I've known for a number of years, watch him grow and develop and be the person that he is today. And this should be a fun interview because is that not just a guest, but someone I consider family from way back when. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, I welcome to the podcast this week my good friend, my brother, my fellow Fortison, Mr. Woolley Harris. Woolley, good afternoon, sir.
Yeah, good afternoon, Jerry. Good to see you.
It's
been a long time, you know. Good to see your face. Yeah.
See him here. We've been on the phone texting and phone calls, but Zoom and seeing each other is a good thing. It's a very good thing. Well, this should be an exciting time talking about, you know, your journey and your family, Auntie Lana, Jumpy, you name it, everybody. So what we want to do is start out how we always do. And basically is to just jump right in. I ask a bunch of open-ended questions, and based on how you respond. I will definitely come up with more questions. So let's just jump right in. So who is Woolley Harris? First, his early years, his family, and coming up in Jamaica. What was that like? Who is Woolley Harris?
Wow, that's a question I'm still trying to answer myself, you know, because I keep reinventing myself over and over and over, which, you know, in my philosophy of life is something that is a blessing, you know, is that each day you get to reinvent yourself, you get to add something more, you know. But my earliest memories were in Bayview, which is out far out east, going towards St. Thomas Pass, Arborview, and going towards Bull Bay. But right before you reach Bull Bay, a beach named Cape Lot Beach is out there. So Bayview is where I really did my younger years, playing on the streets. I remember playing football on a hillside. Right in front of our house was a steep gradient, you know, the road kind of veers up. And we used to play, you know, who get to go uphill first and who get to go downhill first, you know, barefoot, yeah. Right in front of the yard. So those years were fun, you know, because it was just carefree, you know, and my parents were so open in their thinking that, and back then you had more of communal, you know, community-based parenting, where, you know, you could just go anywhere. You knew all the neighbors knew you. They knew your family, and everybody in the community knew one another. So, you know, you couldn't go. If you fell out of line, the neighbor would make sure that you fall back. Yeah. Everybody was, you know, it was a very big, good, close-knit community. So I was out of the house from a very early age. I think my mother just the other day told me that at six, when she and my father was getting married, I went through the community and tell everybody that they were getting married. So, I was on the road at six, and they didn't really have to monitor me or anything like that. But what it gave me is a sense that not only of carefree and learning from other people and getting other perspectives, but it gave me a sense of responsibility as well, you know, because I had to look out for myself from a very early age, and other people that are not necessarily my blood family were looking out for me, and I did the same. You know, so that helped to shape my fundamentals, my ideas and my values, in that the essence of life is really about the people that you meet, you know, and the people that you come into contact with, because they're there to give you something on the journey of yours that you make the decision on them. But, you know, for whatever reason, the universe bring them towards you to nudge you forward and to give you information and to inspire you and to help you along the way. You know, so I really, really value people. From a very early age, I was like that. You know, and I had a lot of friends, a ton of friends. Because unless you do something to really cross me, and even if you cross me, I never wrote you off. You know, I just had that. I really like that about myself is that I never say no. I never block anybody outside of my life. In even if what they do, maybe we're separated for a long time. But even if that is so, just like me and you here today, it seemed like it is yesterday that we just talk to each other. You know, so that for me is really the essence of life, and that is kind of the fundament, the grounding that I had. Is that, you know, open to people and open to relationships and open to information. And my parents were a big part of that because they lived their lives like that. They modeled that, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody that was in the community knew them, and they were open to helping anybody. And in turn, they got the help in return 3, 4, 10-fold, mm-hmm. you know. And you can testify.
I can testify to that. Well,
you know? So, I think they're in their own life and their own parenting. They came to a point where they said, you know, this is if we had a child, we want to instill these values, and they did a pretty good job at that. But for me, my life is all about football. You know, that is my first love. As my father introduced me to the sport, he never really pushed me into the sport, but he introduced it to me, and by virtue of watching him and seeing how he approached the sport and the passion that he put into the sport, I, in turn, you know, kind of garnered some of that passion, gained some of that passion. And once I started playing the sport, I was hooked, you know. Mm-hmm. And they say the goal scoring part of it was a big deal, because that is the expression of all the emotion that goes into all the hard work coming out in one moment, you know. So I was addicted to that feeling, and the goal scoring part really stuck with me. So I think to describe myself is in one word or a few sentences be very difficult. But for me, I just love life.
Just
love life, period. You know, I just it's the most wonderful experience, and the people them that come in and out of my life has been an inspiration to me to becoming a different the person that I am today.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you have countless adopted brothers.
Yeah.
Your parents is by way of your parents, Auntie Lana, Jumpy, coaching through the years and watching them, and it was very, very heartwarming to hear you talk about both of them in that light and the inspiration that they are for you. But your early years coming up through school, your father is a legend in mm-hmm. the eyes of many, in not only Kingston College, but Jamaica in general. Mm-hmm. But coming through, you said something that kind of piqued my interest. You said he never pushed you into the sport, you just developed it. But coming up through grade school, prep school, primary school, then coming to Kingston College, at what age did you know football was it for you?
Probably around 7 or 8. Because my first coach, yes, it was my father, but my first organized football coach was Donald Chinlay at Vaz. Vaz Prep.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was 1983 or 1984. And my father took over the year that he left, you know. So he, you know, my father never, it wasn't the person, at the first coach I did have for organized football. And then even after I played my first year with Vaz, he was my first coach with Marv Ventura and Meadowbrook Brethren. We used to go coach at Calabar and went to KC to Wagga. They took Meadowbrook to Holly Hill Soccer Club International Tournament. So I went on my first international tournament at around 7 or 8, and I was playing right back and stopper. But those two gentlemen were the ones that I got exposed to, you know, very early. So after that, my father took over Vaz, you know, and that second year at Vaz is when I really started moving under his tutelage, and he saw that I really took a big interest in furthering the sport, and you know, he paid attention and gave me obviously the fundamentals and the lessons we need to give me in order to be successful in the sport from starting then. But getting a different perspective from people outside of the household, you know, those three gentlemen was critical as well, you know. Because you know, parents sometimes can because they want the best for their children, put additional pressure and psychological pressure that them themselves don't even know that they're doing, but just because they want it so bad. And I think he recognized that and allowed me to explore more than to, you know, put the pressure on. It's after he saw the amount of interest, I think he put on the full court press, you know?
In
trying to instill in me some of the habits and the values that it takes in order to be successful in the sport.
So when you leave Vaz and you ended up at KC, that just was a natural progression for you?
Yes, very, very natural because, you know, he is my hero at that point in time because of what I saw him do and the things that I've learned from him and the way people revered him, you know, and looked up to him, you know, led me to think because I never saw him play. You know, I didn't have a frame of reference for him. I didn't see any videotape. I never seen anything. But just the amount of respect and the that was shown to him from people who, you know, like for instance, Alan Skillcole and, you know, people who are top football that I learned about. And, you know, just his brethren and people that came around, you know, the amount of respect that was there and the stories that were told, you know, over and over and over. You could only imagine and fill in the blanks yourself, you know. And you might feel, I mean, in a way that is, you know, a little bit more than it was. But I didn't know. Just hearing the different stories and all of them, this was very inspirational. So I put a lot of credibility on him. And I mean, he fulfilled that for me, you know. But when that happened, then it just made sense for me to follow in those footsteps in terms of the schooling. You know, because of what Kingston College stood for. I mean, the motto itself said it all. It's just like, you never give up. You know, the brave may fall, but you never yield. You never give in. You know, you might fail, but you're going to fail trying. You know? And if you have courage, you take the first step forward and the willpower carry through the rest of it. You know? Mm-hmm. You might not get what you want, but you're going to get close and get a lesson that will help you to do it the next time around, which is, I think, was very, very inspirational to me. And I wanted to be a part of that family. I wanted to be a part of that whole, you know, carry on the legacy and, you know, fulfill that by passing and going to Kingston College. Yeah. And it so happened that even in my first year there, I think it was Coach Johnson that coached the Pepsi team when we won. It wasn't him. It was my father. It was him. But my father took me all the way from, I think, third grade through sixth grade. And then from seventh and eighth grade, he came in the eighth grade to coach Colts because we didn't have a Colts coach. But the first year of Pepsi in 1986, I believe, we won the Manning Cup, Colts and Pepsi that year, was the first year at KC and won. So it just kind of solidified and galvanized everything for me. So yeah, I was in the right place.
Yeah. You know? And you know, it was good to see you guys playing. I didn't get to see you guys play that much coming up until I came back because 85, I left and went to Trinidad.
Okay.
So when I came back, all of that was in play. I see you and, you know, obviously Jamal Green. So Jamal and I talked about that. I will tell you one thing, though, just to stick a point here. Just last week, I was speaking with Mr. Ventura, and I said to him, Mr. Ventura, we need to get some of your stories out of your head and record it so people can see and hear. So just hold out a little hope for me because he is thinking about it. So you can imagine if we have Mr. Ventura and your father sharing them stories, you know, it will be very, very powerful for us.
I agree. I look up to my Uncle Marv. I look up to him because remember, I tried my hand at cricket as well, and he was determined to turn me into a batsman. And boy, I couldn't bat. You know, but we could have keep wicket, could I grab all the balls. So. We try everything.
I remember that. And then people come to his house.
Yes.
On the concrete pad in the back.
Yeah. And I remember it's an orange plastic ball and then wet the tire.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think it was Mario Ventura that bowled and, you know, step forward, play forward. What is play forward? I don't understand. Yep.
Ventura. Just so you know, I ask him and he's going to consider it because he doesn't like talking about himself, but his story needs to come out. So, KC, you go through the ranks, Pepsi, Colts, and then I think
Manning Cup. Yeah.
And then you left, and then your career just kind of took off from a perspective. Yeah.
We did Manning Cup.
How you got from KC to Clemson?
Well, the story is that 1989, I believe, you know, I was in 11th grade, finished up CXC and all of that. I think I got like three passes or four passes out of like seven or something like that. And so I would have to obviously repeat and take those exams over again. And I think I was like 17 at the time, 16, 17, or 16, going to be 17 or something like that. And my parents made the decision to say, you know, if we're going to go to college, if we want him to go to college, at some point we're going to have to get assimilated or acclimated to the system of schooling in the United States. You know, and at the time, I had already had a green card due to my father's and my mom's travels, and they're doing business in between the two countries. I was, you know, fortunate enough to have a green card at that time. And Jamal, at the time, I think, didn't have his, but he had a way to get in the country. He had a P9 or P90 or something like that, they called it. And his parents and my parents were very, very close. And we were close. We were like brothers. So, you know, he decided to move with us to Orlando, Florida, where, you know, they said was, you know, a better place for schooling. The standard there was pretty high. And some family friends recommended a school. And that is kind of where it took off. And we went into 11th grade at Winter Park High School in Orlando. And, you know, we did well with the soccer team. Obviously, we got recognized through playing soccer at the school and doing very, very well, all state and all of that. Both Jamal and I, same thing. And, you know, colleges came and looked at us. And one of the colleges was Clemson, who directly scouted Jamal. And I actually got scouted by UConn and a couple other schools. So Jamal went on a college visit to Clemson, and I went on a college visit to UConn, where I met up with a former Vaz teammate, Michael Saunders. And so he inspired me to come back and say, well, I have somebody to look up to. I have somebody kind of mentor me through, you know, this whole college experience, because he's there. And, you know, Michael was a goal scorer too. At Vaz, him score goals like nobody's business, you know. We had this saying, score a hat-trick and get a Patrick, you know, back in the store. And him just score a hat-trick. It's be a hat-trick, him just score.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say, you know, if I'm going to be a goal scorer and be successful going forward, he's a good person, both on the field and off. And so I took the opportunity to go to UConn my freshman year. And I played all the games, scored a few goals, but I was playing the number 10, the midfield. And, you know, I just didn't... Coming from where I was coming from, with all the people that gave me the inspiration and information that I needed to succeed, I didn't think I was in the right environment for that, you know, and I made a decision. I mean, at the time, I look back at it and I say, wow, you had a full scholarship, and you would have leave the full scholarship and go take a half scholarship somewhere else just because you recognize that, you know, you needed better on the football inside. And that was wild to me when I look back, because at the end of the day, North Jamaican youth, that's all them work for, is to get a full scholarship somewhere, yeah. You know? And I was willing to forego that for get to a better, even better place. That was wild. But I was fortunate that when I called Jamal at Clemson, the coach was interested in getting another attacking person. And he flew me down for a college visit. I got my release at the time from the athletic department. And I transferred to Clemson. So after 1 year at UConn, that's how I ended up at Clemson.
You know, I didn't know you went to UConn. I thought it was Clemson straight through. So you say this is what, and this, you said something very interesting. I want to pause here for a moment and talk about this issue of student athletes. You are now a coach, which we'll get to in a minute, in the MLS, assistant coach. But when you think about your experience, you know, you just talked about Kingston College and the decisions your family made and the CXC, and you're preparing yourself for the next level. When you hear the term student athlete, what does that mean to you? What rises up in you when you hear that term student athlete?
For me, well, no, you know, going through it, I didn't think about it that much, the relationship. But now that I look back on it as a, you know, coach and person that's been through it, I think it's very important that you balance the two, because they play. They're part and parcel of each other. You know, it takes a good education and being able to reason through problems, being able to go through those spaces of self-doubt, but yet still trying to find and research new information in order to develop your own analysis and process of analyzing information. And that is what sports are all about, is just dealing with information and making decisions in a dynamic environment. You know, so I think high school education plays a critical part in some ways, in some fundamental ways of how you analyze information. And if the better you and actually making an informed choice, you know, one that involves some, you know, gathering information, some analysis, and then the output, you know, and doing that very, very rapidly. So the more you can develop those skills, you know, outside of the sport, it's easier to just transfer those same skills into the sport and learning new things. Obviously, you're going to have to do your homework, which is the repetition, you know, in the sport, but it still is like the same thing, you know? So yeah. I think part of it is very important that you balance the two. You know, the education piece is critical because you're going to run up into information. You're going to need new information in order to get better. And you have to be able to deal with not only the emotional side of what that information presents. Oh, I don't know this from Adam. I need to find out more. You know, I remember some math class that I went to, and I was just like, yo, I can't do this. But more and more, I research and I find out the processes, and it's really all about sticking to the process. You know, there's steps there. Take the steps, but it takes you going out there and finding out, you know, and then taking the steps. And then once you do the repetition, it becomes very easy, you know. So it's the same concept in the world of sports, you know. So if you can do balance the two, I think you're setting yourself up for success, not only on the field, but more so off.
Do you think as a coach, that's something, if you were a coach in the high school, collegiate level, let's just go all the way back to Jamaica. If you're a coach in high school in Jamaica, the question is, should the coach be pushing this more, this response you just gave, should that be something that's top of mind for every coach to be having these students to be thinking about both?
I think so, because yes, you know, sports is a segue to lead into a career, but at the end of the day, the education is what sticks with you for your entire life. How you deal with people, how you deal with the information that you get, and how you deal with your own emotions that come arise because of new information. You know, you can't dispute the fact that new information sparks something in you, whether good, bad, or indifferent, and how you handle those things. You know, I think it's something that it directly correlates to how you excel in the sport. So yes, the coach should be pushing for, you know, these kids to get, you know, ear on the side of education, because that's what's going to last. The sports time you play the sport is finite, you know, it's very small, but your life journey, you know, is a lot longer.
So getting back to you now, Wole, Clemson, now since you dropped this on me that your freshman year was at UConn, Clemson, you played the rest of your time, but you are now a Clemson Hall of Famer, and I think you still have the record for the most goals. So you did all that in 3 years.
Yes. Yeah, but
walk us through that, because a lot of people play 4 years and they don't get to the levels that you get, Hall of Fame, records at the school. What was it like at Clemson? And because it looks like that's where everyone knew, or I knew, you took off your collegiate to pro career, kind of took off at Clemson. Was it that much different than UConn?
Yes, it was a lot different. In one, the school was more like a family, you know, especially the athletic department. The people who played sports at the school, we had facilities specifically geared for us, you know, from the educational standpoint, and the facilities from the sporting standpoint was exclusive to us. You know, and I think they paid attention to that. Whereas UConn, they did, but they didn't allocate as much resources to it as Clemson did. You know, the second thing was the philosophy of the coaches. I think for UConn, it was more about participating, being dominant in the Big East. Whereas just not really paying attention to the finer details in how we play the sport, how you attack, how you defend. What do you want to get out of each game, you know, specific stuff, versus going to Clemson, where the coach there was from Israel, I believe, Ibrahim, and he was an attacking coach. And for an attacker, you know, he was the person that he'd want to win a game 6-4. He'd rather win a game 6-4 than 1-0. So for me, you know, as a goal scorer, that told me that, one, I was in the right place, because the person that's coaching the team has an attacking mind. But two, he knew the sport so well that he recruited people for every single position that would cater to the goal scorers that he had on the team. You know, so when you talk about the goals that were scored, I was on the finishing end of it, but the people that are around me providing the opportunity were very, very skillful people. You're talking about people like Miles Joseph, Imad Baba, both of these guys are U.S. internationals. Matt Jordan, who was the goalkeeper, is now the general manager of Houston, Houston Dynamo in the MLS. Jamal Green, obviously Jamaican international as well, and Nidal and Imad were key in the midfield. They're very, you know, very intelligent midfielders. And then we filled in the other spots with very athletic people. You know, Rivers Guthrie was a very skillful winger as well. And basically, I was a box forward. I made my money in and around the penalty area. I wasn't the type of forward that pick up the ball at midfield, dribble four people, and then kick it, you know, or dribble and go into the box and beat the keeper and slot it. I was a box forward, so I relied a lot on service, you know. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the style of play was into the forward, back to the midfield, out to the wings, you know, kind of bring the team in, get them compact, then spread them out again in the final third, cross the ball, and I would arrive, you know, find a way to get myself into a position to get a shot off, because I could shoot with both right and left and I could head. So, you know, it was all about kind of developing a relationship with these people. And once I did that, you know, they knew where to find me without even looking. And that played a part in a lot of the goals that I scored were not necessarily tap-ins, but was in good positions that created a lot of uncertainty for the opponent, you know, and indecision. And that is where I kind of fill in the blank and say I took advantage of that. So I got a lot of chances just by either waiting or having a relationship with somebody that they knew exactly when them get to a certain point where I'd be, and they put the ball there. Right. And that's where a lot of the goals, you know.
Now, you mentioned box forward. I've never heard that before. So, and you describe it. So, growing up in Jamaica, you see people like Errol Salah Lewis and Herbert Richards and Chupa Marga. They go all the way back and they dribble it all the way. Adonis Maxwell, all of these guys we grew up and watch.
Yeah.
What you would call, those are just attacking forwards in your in the language that you'd use.
No, they're forwards too, but they're just special. Those are the forwards like, you know, the Cristianos and the Ronaldinhos and those are the Robinhos. Those are the forwards that can unbalance a defense at any point in time. And those are the forwards that were revered because of our society valued and appreciated skill.
Yeah.
You know, didn't really see goal scoring as a skill. They just saw it as the end product of what the skill provided. You know,
come up.
And you needed, for me, goal scoring was a skill because you needed it to win. The dribbling didn't make you win. The dribbling didn't lead to the final product. But at the end of the day, you can't dribble five man and win a match.
Right.
You know? But you still have to put the ball in the goal.
Yeah.
So that is what
any amount of pile and salad and
they were having the fun doing all of that, and I was very appreciative of them, because I remember watching Salah Lewis go down the left side, and it was just a joy to watch. Trust me, Herbert is the same thing, you know, same type of dynamic, and Danny Maxwell and Bucky Barnes and all them, same thing. But I found joy in putting the ball in the goal. And, you know, guys like Headley and them, man, the up front yourself. All of the forward them is the man I'm immediately looked at and said, all right, I want to be like him. I want to be in those positions. Because, give me the ball in front of the goal. You can do all you want. On the wing and in the middle, people look crazy. I salad them and them come back and you salad them again. And no, me put the ball in the goal. That's what I did love in the game.
So, Clemson, a storied career at Clemson. What happened? What was next after Clemson?
For me, the from a very young age is always becoming a pro. Always playing, and I remember watching Manchester. You remember when you had football international every Sunday?
Yep.
You had football international TV, and we'd play football on the field, out in the yard, or wherever, until football international came on, and that is when I not necessarily fell in love with Man U, but I gravitated towards Man U, because of how they played, the players that were there, you know. And Cantona and them on there. Them forward there was very inspirational to me. And, you know, I always wanted to play professional football. Pele was my idol growing up, and I saw he played all over the world. And in fact, here in the United States too. And I was just like, I want to be that person. I want to experience the highest level. You know, I never even think about international football until I turned pro. You know, or was going to turn pro actually, because I think I got my first cap in my senior year at Clemson. But I never really thought, the end goal was always to play professionally. It didn't matter where or how, but somehow there. And, you know, just by the exploits at Clemson, I got attracted some attention. not only here in the United States, but overseas as well. It's just that I chose to stay here in the United States. And in my senior year, I was projected to be drafted in MLS draft in 1996 when the the inception of the league here in the United States. And I never got drafted at all. So that was an interesting blow. And I said, well, what's the next best team, which was Division II, and there was a team in Atlanta called the Atlanta Rockets that used to come up and scrimmage Clemson. It had international players in it, like Bruce Murray, that played for the United States for a very long time, and I was a former Clemson alum as well. And, you know, knowing these type of people, knowing these people coming to Clemson and having that relationship, I said, well, that was the next step. And I ended up getting drafted by Atlanta. And then a good friend of my father, another 40 spirit man, Lon Donaldson, who was the women's coach that just went to the Jamaica national team, women's coach that just went to the World Cup this past, when is it, 2 years ago? He was the coach of a team called the Colorado Foxes, which played in the same league as Atlanta. And he traded for me, traded with Atlanta. I don't know what he traded, but he traded for me to come to Colorado Foxes. At the time, who at the time had a player called Walter Boyd playing for them. And everybody know Walter Boyd, the Blacks.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I got that opportunity, I was very happy, you know, because I said, well, I'm going to play with one of the best players that Jamaica, whoever come out of Jamaica and playing pro, him and can show me the way. And then Lon was a Fortis, you know, alum, KC alum. And actually, my father coached Lon in Money Cup. So it was kind of wild how is more of one degree of separation than two when it comes to people, you know. And because I don't know. I just flourished under his tutelage. You know, I just flourished. And I remember one practice, he came up to me first year and he said, you can do something really special here. You know, I can do something. Just pull me to the side and say, we're going to get you the opportunities. You just score the goals and you'll get to where you want to go. You know, because he knew I wanted to be in the MLS. And I ended up doing real well that first year. And by the second year, coming out of college, I was in the MLS at the highest level in the United States, but still the highest level.
Still the highest level. So what was your first team in the MLS?
Colorado Rapids, the same team that I'm coaching right now as an assistant, which is interesting to me because I find the correlations wild. You know, I don't know if it's how the universe set to work, but I came in through the USL, what is now the USL, our second division, to get to MLS from a Colorado team, Colorado Springs. I was the assistant coach for 5 years in Colorado Springs from 2014 to 2019. And then I left that job. And within a year, now I'm back in the MLS in Colorado again at the club that I used to play for. You know, so both pathways as a player and as a coach has led through the second division up into the first division through, you know, to MLS through in the same state, which was, I found that I don't know what is written in the universe, but it's just my pathway to going to the top has been through Colorado.
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, this podcast is about young people and here having guests come on and share their stories to inspire young people, because right now things are kind of tough. We have COVID, young people, you know, they're susceptible to thinking, is this it? But hearing your story, question I have for you, and I've asked this of several guests, as you look back over your career, you know, and your life really, is there, you knew at around 7 or 8 you wanted to play football. And then you knew you wanted to be pro. You accomplished all of that. Was there a straight line from when you wanted to do it to when you achieved it? Or is there just ups and downs, hills and valleys, lessons learned? Which one would you say?
I think it's all of the above. And the way my philosophy in certain ways and view of life is that you come in through your mother, but you leave by yourself. Right. So every decision that you make, you're tailoring this experience for yourself. And for me, in my own personal experience has been once I've made a decision and I start putting action behind it, it didn't matter what kind of action I took, as long as I took action towards the same goal that I have. Meaning that the choice that I'm adding value every single day. in every choice that I make, adding value, getting me, taking the baby steps towards the goal. Because in those baby steps are the lessons that you need to learn in order to sustain when you get to the top. If you don't take those baby steps and you make a leap, then hopefully you have the openness and the ability to reflect and see what steps you leap over, and you have those in your arsenal already, or you need to go back and kind of tighten up some of those, because at the end of the day, you're going to need them at some point in time to come out in order to further you, you know? And the road is not a straight road. Sometimes you have to take some lane. Sometimes it's a dirt road. Sometimes it's a rocky road, which means you're going to get challenged and you're going to get pushed. But all that is to help you to not only gain humility, but also for you to gain an understanding of yourself. Because once you understand yourself and how you work, and how you create processes and design your pathway for yourself plays a critical role in how quickly you get to the goal, yeah. You know, and gathering information as you go, and not judging yourself too much for it, but just sticking to it and trusting that one day, once you keep pushing towards it, you'll get the opportunity. So it's really to be ready at the time the opportunity cross your path. Because if you don't, then you're going to have to go through some more lessons and wait for the opportunity to come again. And it might not for a very long time. You know, that's just my experience, you know, because my pathway to this job has been, since 2011. You know, when I came back to the United States from Jamaica, finished up my degree, and I ended up being a college coach, a student assistant, just looking at what it takes to become a top-level coach, the work ethic, the dedication, the commitment, the time commitment especially, the information that you have to process, the people who you have to deal with, the players who you have to manage. Just looking at that whole process, that was my first experience off the field, just watching it in action and learning from it, you know? And then now having to wait some 10 years from that in order to reach the top. But all over those 10 years, I was adding value each and every year in some way, shape, form, or fashion, that when the opportunity came here, I was ready, you know? And that is how I approach life. And I'd advise, you know, any youngster coming up to have that in mind, that you're not going to get to the top very, very fast. And if you get there very fast, you'd be better be very careful and know, you know, try to look back at some of the things that got you there. One, but also keep adding value to yourself. Don't let complacency slip in, because once that happens and you stop growing and you stop evolving, then it's easy for you to move out of that space.
Yeah, so well said, Wole. So well said. Well, another question I have is, you had the opportunity to represent Jamaica. You remember the Reggae Boys team, and I remember seeing you in Washington, D.C. one time. The team stayed there, and we saw you after practice, and it was just like a big family, that team. Can you talk a little bit about what that felt like to you? You represented Jamaica many times, but being a member of the Reggae Boys, what was that like?
Oh, it was one of the best experiences of my footballing career. I mean, to measure it in all right, so not being on the World Cup team and playing on that stage as a failure, I would say no. I mean, just by virtue of being on the team, you know, you is a success in itself, because so many other footballers were out there, but you were selected. You know, I was selected. So for me, it was great just to be selected, but even better to go out there on the field and showcase my skills and do it with people who, you know, really, really had a deep sense of pride in representing the country, you know, and representing all the people in the country that love this sport. You know, as I said to you before in the podcast, the essence of life is really the people. And I think we had a deep sense of that while we were doing it. You know, the people that were there, we cared about each other. I mean, just the selections didn't always go away, but we're still friends to this day. You know, we're still family to this day. So I think that is the part of it that I really cherish, is those relationships that created. I mean, myself, Andy Williams, and Tyrone Marshall, we're coming from prep school, you know, and we all represented the country at the same time. I had that experience together. It's wonderful, you know. And as I said before, the people them that we we played with Tapper and Warren Barrett and, you know, Shorty Malcolm and obviously Walter Boyd and even the players that came from India. And those are quality people, you know, good people. So it was just a joy and it was an honor to represent the country, you know, to wear the colors and go out and play on the international stage and represent the people them that are back home that love football and love the sport.
Love the sport. Now, professionally, you're coaching, assistant coach for a top-tier MLS professional team. What is that like? What is it like being a coach of a professional team? What is that like?
Long hours. I'm still getting used to the workflow right now. Trust me. It's somewhat become a science. You know, if not a science right now, the coaching has, because it entails so much detail, you know, from the sports scientists who track the load and how much high intensity sprints you do, the players doing a training, to the strength and conditioning where they're all scientists in their own right, and then they come to the actual coaching staff now, where you develop the tactics, you implement the style of play, and you have to break down the game into small pockets of, you know, of really coming up to from 1v1 all the way up to 4v4, because that's what the game comes down to. There's only one ball, and most of the time is anywhere in between one to four players on your team and the opposition in and around the ball at any one time. You know, so you're breaking down all the fundamentals of the game and the tactical part of the game into those small pockets, and then training them. And then but you still have to have a vision of what you want the end product to be like. You know, and this is not to mention the psychological part of the game, which is just how do you manage, you know, a roster of 27 people at a high level and affect, influence their minds to buy into what your philosophy is, you know. It's not an easy gig, you know, and it takes long hours of coordinating all the departments at the club, all the departments on the technical staff. Because not all that is just this is what I'm talking about. It's just on the football side of things. You're not talking about the business side of things, where you have to deal with sponsorships and, you know, merchandising, television rights, and interviews, and all of that type of stuff. You know, so I'm just getting used to the workflow right now. Yeah, I tell you, I'm in the right place. Yeah. I wouldn't want it any other way. You know.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because I remember you as a youngster, and, you know, Eelsham, Kevin, Auntie Lana Bell hanging out at her house and all of that, and watching you grow and develop, and just looking at your face on this podcast right now, is it safe to say that you found your niche?
Yeah, for sure. But it's from like earlier on, I realized, actually coming out of the sport is when I realized it. When I left the sport in 2006 and I moved back to Jamaica 2007, went into construction with my father, and we were going to do some things. And 2008 hit, and that changed a lot for our family in terms of finances and all of that. And it put us in a space where you had to reinvent yourself, you know, and start over, so to speak. It really forced me to realize that, hey, is every day you get the opportunity for change where you think you is, you are.
Right,
yeah?
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, move into a space where you had all the resources and then you don't have it and you have to be creative to come up with it, you know, and create it yourself. Well, put me in a space where it's just like, all right, well, if that is what life is, or that is how life is going to be, you have to be accepting of that and just start move. You know, see, because once you start move, everything will fall into place for you, but you have to take action. And that is where I move into that space, and I just keep taking action.
So let me ask you this. I ask you this question because you're an inspiration to many. I don't know if you know that. And usually, you're a very humble individual. And as I sit here listening to you, you have a gift. It's obvious to many that you have a gift: goal scoring, athleticism. Because, you know, you play cricket, people just know Woolley Harris was an athlete. If you were talking to young Jamaicans who wanted to break into coaching, what's the process they should go through? You know, you have to get the license and all of that. But can you talk a little bit about any little nuggets of wisdom? Because a lot of them have talent and skill, but the formal aspects they need to get done. What would you say to them?
Wow, that's an interesting question because I can go so many places with it. But the first is, if you play the sport, you'd have to start getting information about positioning first. You know, learn each line, you know, from the goalkeeper to the defense to the back to the midfielder to the forward. What are the roles and responsibilities of the players? And once that goes on, then you look at the technical aspect, what is required from these players, you know, in order to execute what you want them to do, and learn about that. And then I would look at how you got to go ahead to train that, you know. And once you go through those areas, you start finding out which ones you don't know, which ones you know. And that is where you know that you have to pay attention to those areas and seek that information. That is where the licensing and the education part come in, you know. So I think playing the sport is a big educational point. But if you never play the sport, then you have to investigate what the sport entails, you know the dimensions of the pitch, what the rules are, that those are the fundamentals, you know the positions and know what them require. And then, you know, watch the sport, see what the level teams in the world do, and then try to model that, you know, and then get information on how to train that, because that is what you see on the field is a lot of repetition. What you don't see is when the guys are in the training, spending the time perfecting those aspects of the game. You just see the game. The spectators just see the game, you know, and the coaches are the ones that really delve into how do you train and create these habits in the players. Yeah. And that is what you're trying to do. You're trying to break a certain habit that a player have and have him create another habit with a group of players. You know? So if once you have that information, then you're looking to just seek and get more and more information. And I believe the GFF have several licenses now that they made available. And there's obviously right now with the advent of the internet, the world is flat in terms of information. You can find a lot of information on the internet. So I would say you're going to have to spend some time on doing a lot of reading on how to, you know, navigate some of these and create some of these things for yourself. But getting the information is the key. The licensing only give you, said to somebody else that I know these things, or I know this bit of information. That's all the licensing say. Or I've had the experience over a period of time of using this, you know. So once you get the license, it's just saying, all right, I just know this bunch of information, you know. And I know how to apply it, you know. Yeah. But so some of the coaches don't have that secondary part as far as the application. They know the information, but to apply it and affect change and be successful at it takes a certain type of skill level as well. You have to go through some failures and come back again, you know. So that is how I would say to go about it. And if all else fails, play the sport. Go out and play. Because just by virtue of playing the sport, you realize certain things about each line and what goes into it, you know. But I would seek, and if you can, find a mentor. Find somebody that has been there that can pass it down to you.
Has anybody reached out to you for you to mentor them in the coaching space?
No. People ask me about, you know, just ask me general questions, but nobody has reached out and said, hey, you know, how do you do this? Or what do you think of this? Or, how, you know, how do you approach this part of the game? Or, you know, what have you? I haven't had that yet. But,
well, that's interesting because you're absolutely right. We all need mentors to get better. I have a couple more questions for you, my friend.
Yeah, man, shoot.
What's next for you? You're an assistant. You're at the highest level coaching in the U.S. Mm-hmm. What is next for Woolley Harris?
I can't tell you past this job because I'm so involved right now. I'm so absorbed by it, you know, because right now I just got to the MLS. To be honest, you know, and moving from the USL, which is the second division, to the first division, there's a lot more information and a lot more processes, a lot more things I have to learn here. You know, the game is so detailed at this level, I can't even imagine the Premier League, to be honest. You understand? It's just wild how much information we get here. I mean, last night we were in the office till about 1:30 from about 1:30 a.m. from about 11 a.m. We played a preseason game against one of our rival teams, preseason game in which the first team started the first 60 minutes, and the team that we consider a second team play. And we watched each and every play probably 2 to 3, up to 5 times, just breaking each and every facet, which touch, which foot, where this should go, where that player should go, when them should go, how them should go, who them need to talk to, who. And all of this is now going to go into the next practice a day from now. You understand? Wow. The level of detail and level of attention to detail is so high that because the margins are so fine. You know, one step wrong and it's a goal. One step forward and you block a goal. So is that amount of time and dedication you have to have. And I'm just getting used to that workflow, you know, and then being able to go back to the players and paint a picture that help them to understand what you require from them and what the game demands from them at any one point in time. And you and I know that the game is 45 minutes, you get a 15-minute break, and you do 45 more. So much happened on both sides of the ball, both defensively and offensively, in different areas of the pitch that can affect the outcome. Not to mention weather and all kind of other things that can affect, you know, the style of play and the performance. The level of detail, level of attention to detail is so much that I just kind of get my foot underneath me.
I couldn't tell you what is next right now,
Jerry. But I know that mastering this whole process is something that might take a little while. But I'm putting everything behind it.
Yeah, well, I tell you, as a brother and a friend, and watching you, all I can say, I'm proud of you, sir. Really proud of you, and
give thanks.
Inspiring so many people. But family, how's family for you? You know, how are things? You know, dad, mom. You know, your mom and I are WhatsApp regularly.
Yeah.
I'll be checking with Auntie Lana. You know.
Yeah.
How's that going? How's the balance for Woolley Harris?
Yeah, it was, you know, as I said to you before, it was kind of interesting how our life works, you know, because when I left Florida and a family in 2014 to become a professional coach at the second division level, and at the time I had a 3-year-old daughter, you know, and she's now 9, and I was just like, wow, that is the hardest thing. I think that was the hardest decision I ever had to make in my life, is to leave my daughter at 3 and, you know, and not be there every day for her, because every day since she born, me and her are together, like, you know what, you know, very, very close. And then after, you know, obviously every break, you know, we should come out, fly her out, and, you know, so forth and so on. And I got a break after 5 years of doing that. I got a break, and then COVID hit. I got a break, and I wasn't working in a professional environment. So I got to spend a whole year with her, you know, and my mother and my father was in the same space. And my brother, them at certain times, we're all in the same space at the same time. And I don't think that has happened since about 1992. So for some people, 2020 was rough, but for me, 2020 was good in the sense that I get to spend it in around my family. Now, we couldn't go nowhere; we had to be around each other. It was wild. So the family is good, but you know, I think she's at that age right now that she understands what daddy is all about, and you know, she knows that daddy loves her, and daddy is away, but he's working, and she just started playing football herself. You know, so. She get in for love it in her own way. And she just see what I do and pick it up. So as my father did me, I never push her. Right. You know, just gradually she just kind of gravitated towards it. Me and her mom are very cool, very civil. Not together, but we're very, very civil. And we know that this is bigger than us. It's all about creating an environment for our youth. And she has been, you know, the biggest growth for me is coming through my child. You know, because she teach me a lot about life, and teach me a lot about myself. Because in order for me to help her growing up, I have to evolve as a parent, because I am the model. You know, I'm the one that she observes and she learns how to solve problems from. And the quicker I evolve, the quicker she will evolve, and the better she will become. So family wise, I think she's great right now. My mother is great. Father is in I believe is in New York right now. You know, father of another family going on. So, you know, it's just an extended family. Don't talk as much as we used to, but, you know, I'm still doing things, still alive and doing things. And my brothers are all over the world. One brother is in Japan. You know, he's been living over there for quite some time, teaching English. And my other brother is in Jamaica. And he is a grower. So, so we all have a little life parts are gone. But everybody's doing well. Give thanks.
Yeah. Well, give thanks for that. You know, the spiritual side of you as well is something that I've come to respect over time. And, you know, you mentioned it a couple of times here in the podcast, the universe and stuff. You're a very grounded individual. But I wanted to ask you a question. Probably, believe it or not, we're close to the hour. But you're now a coach. You have to inspire. You mentioned just now the psychological aspects of getting your players ready, getting them to break bad habits and things like that. I've asked all of my guests on the program if they could share words of encouragement and uplift to our young people or people in their midlife, because COVID has really exposed just how vulnerable some folks are in terms of lack of vision, lack of stick-to-itiveness. Mm. To close out this interview, what words of inspiration you could leave with people that, you know, might be going through right now, your experiences, your journey, the lessons you have learned, what would you share with them, specifically, globally, but more importantly, back home in Jamaica?
There's an inspirational, you're pretty sure you know, there's an inspirational speaker named Les Brown. You ever heard of Les Brown?
Yes, sir.
I listened to him, some of his speeches, and one really resonated with me. He said, if there's no enemy within, the enemy outside can do you no harm. And that to me really, really stuck with me. That means the only battle in my life is with myself. Everything else outside is just stimulus, and it just creates an energy within it, what we call emotion. And if you get stuck in the emotional space, you don't really think rationally. You just react to life. So if something happened in your life, you don't give the emotion time to settle, that you come to rational thought and say, was that really for me? And what we do is take it on, we make it our own, by our own choices, we react to it, and then we find ourselves in a spot, you know? And for me, I think if we just let that emotion sit and we come to rational thought, then you can make a choice that is beneficial to you. Every decision in your, from the time you're born, except for when obviously your parents grow you, from the time you're born to the time you leave in death, is you're making decisions. And this life, you're the one that orchestrated. You're the one that tailored for yourself. You know, people come along and give you certain things to help you along that way. But the decisions are really yours. So you have to conquer yourself. You have to look within yourself and move it, help try to find a way to deal with yourself and recreate yourself and move some of those negative things out the way so that you can make good decisions for yourself. And in turn, for me, in my experience, is that it tailors up whoever you believe in, God, Allah, whatever, the universe, it delivers it for you within the lifetime. You know, but you have to show, it's like you have to show, say you want it, you know, and move it. But the only real battle is with yourself. Just know that. So if you can look inside yourself and really be honest with yourself and forgive yourself for some of your transgressions, you know, and and then now step forward into a space of creating, recreating yourself, you'll find that things just come towards you. It's wild, you know, them call it the law of attraction or whatever. But for me, I would say take the first step in looking within first, because if you know that well, that is where the big man resides, if you believe
exactly.
in
it. So exactly. Speak, exactly. You know?
Yeah. And from once you're grounded in that, everything else will be provided unto you in whichever space you want to step into. That has been an experience, so I can't talk about nothing else.
Well, Wole, the hour has passed, my brother. And listen, first and foremost, thank you for doing this for me. I know the Fortis family will love this. I know the young people who have been following this podcast, and believe it or not, parents and grandparents, they just love the honesty and the candor of the guests that come onto the podcast, and you have delivered just in the vein of all the others. And the folks that are asked to come onto this show, it still blows my mind who actually say yes, they'll do it. And I'm very appreciative of that. And just that you'd spend this hour with me sharing and, you know, trying to help give back to our nation, Jamaica, the world, as to how, you know, it really is easy, son, that my coach used to say. We are the one that's make it difficult. Mm. This life, what you get out of it is what you put in. That's basically it. And I just want to say thank you. And Godspeed. I'm watching from a distance. I know a lot of people watching you from a distance because folks will send me emails and clippings and texts about you. That's how I found out about your interview.
Wow. That's wild. So,
yeah, that's wild, right? Yeah, people watch and people are inspired. Mm. So thank you, my friend. Yeah. And, you know, Godspeed. Anything I can do for you, you know, I'm here. Just let me know.
And I just want to say thank you to Jerry. And I want you to know personally that I'm also proud of you. Because trust me, I see some of the things that you do in terms of moving from Cornell, from one spot to the other, and it seems like you just keep moving up and up. So that's why I know so I'm proud of you too, and thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we just spent an hour with my good friend, my Fortis brother, my family brother, extended family. All of the football fraternity from Kingston College is his brother in some way, shape, or form. My good friend, Woolley Harris. I hope something was shared here today, something piqued your interest, and we'll have you to look at your station in life in a different way. So until next week, take care. This is Gerald Hector, and it's easy, son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. Until next time, take care of yourself.